David became king. How David became king. And the problem that confronted David was how to get from A to B. How to get from A to B. That is, how to get from the situation that we read of at the beginning of the second book of Samuel, when the kingdom of Israel was completely divided and devastated, to the situation that we read of, or we read of in chapter 5, when he brings a united kingdom together and is then able to conquer Jerusalem and destroy the Philistines. So how does he get from A, the appalling inheritance he received, to B, reigning then over a united kingdom that can defeat the enemies of God? So jumping back for a moment, when Saul was called to be king and anointed by Samuel back in 1 Samuel chapter 9, then Samuel explained how he as king had two basic purposes to fulfill. We read in 1 Samuel chapter 9 verses 15 to 17, the Lord revealed to Samuel, "Tomorrow at about this time I will send you to a man from the land of Benjamin, and you are to anoint him to be ruler over my people, Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines." That's the first purpose. And then secondly, "For I've seen my people, because their cry has come to me. And when people saw Saul," and who's now been anointed king, "the Lord told him, 'Here is the man of whom I spoke to you. He is the man who shall restrain my people. He is the man who shall restrain my people.'" So the two functions that he's given, two purposes, to restrain the people. Remember, we're coming out of the period of judges, a period of anarchy, of factionalism with Israel. He's got to restrain this. He's got to end this period of division and bloodshed and anarchy within the land. And he's then got to conquer the enemies, especially the Philistines. And you'd recognize, most of you, I guess, that these are two basic fundamental purposes of government, aren't they? But on the one hand, to have secure borders that protect you from your enemies. And on the other hand, to have law and order within the land. These are the requirements of the kingship, as we would put them, or as Samuel said, to deliver the land from the Philistines and to restrain the people, to bring them together and stop all this factionalism. And sadly then, as we read 2 Samuel, as it opens, we find that Saul utterly fails, doesn't he? He's a complete failure, because the inheritance, as I've said, that leads to David is one that is marked by division and Philistine domination. They've just been totally defeated, routed by the Philistines at Mount Gilboa. The royal family has been almost wiped out. The king himself, Saul, has been killed. Their leadership then removed. And worse than that, they are divided, because we read very quickly of the outbreak of civil war between the north and the south. If you read carefully through the books of Samuel and Kings, you see then that a north-south divide was a recurring problem within Israel. Division then that comes later after Solomon of a northern and southern kingdom has been present, bubbling under for a long time. And it erupts here then in this early what would be reign of David as he takes over, because civil war breaks out then between the north under the house of Saul and the south under David in Judah. So we have then a desperately divided people who break into civil war, and we have the Philistines rampaging over the land. We shouldn't overestimate the Philistine underestimate the Philistine domination. The fact that Ishbosheth is made king in the north, it's over at Manahim across the River Jordan, and he probably had very little influence. He didn't have much power. And David similarly was down in the south, and in between, the great majority of the land controlled by the Philistines. So this was the inheritance then. This is, as I say, point A. This is what David inherits and where he starts. But then, as we read in chapter 5, where he gets to is a united kingdom that is able to destroy his enemies. So we read that United Kingdom and the destruction of the enemies. Then, as I say, in chapter 5, when at last the tribes of Israel come to David and they ask him to be their king. And following his bringing all the tribes together under the one leader, the one king, united the kingdom, they then can immediately go on to conquer Jerusalem and defeat the Jebusites, which of course had never been done since they came into the promised land. And then they rout the Philistines twice over and drive them out. So how did David then get from point A to point B? So first of all, then we consider David's shrewd politics. David, as it were, is the shrewd, the wise politician. And we see this in three ways in which he acts then. Three ways in which he acts. First of all, at the beginning of chapter 1. So we didn't read this, but after the death of Saul and so on Mount Gilboa, then this man, an Amalekite, he finds Saul dead. We know from the account 1 Samuel, and he takes his armour and he rushes to David to curry favour with David. He brings him the armour and he claims then to have killed Saul. And he thinks this will be applauded by David. He thinks David will be really pleased with this. But of course, the opposite is the case. David is angry with him. He himself, as we consider, he wouldn't touch Saul, the Lord's anointed king. And he's angry at this man has done so. He's killed the Lord's anointed. And so David says to him, were you not afraid to destroy the Lord's anointed? And so he has this Amalekite put to death, executed. Now, this isn't merely David being consistent, though it is that he himself wouldn't kill Saul. But it is a political statement, isn't it? He's saying to the house of Saul, he's saying to the tribes of the north, I didn't kill Saul and I want nothing to do with the death of Saul. In fact, I brought justice for the man who killed Saul. It's a shrewd political move to show to the people in the north, the house of Saul, what's left of it then, that he wants to work with them. He wants to woo them. He wants to win them to be under his leadership. So first of all, when we have his action then in killing this Amalekite, a judicial action to kill the man who claims he slew the Lord's anointed. But then secondly, we have this lament that we read, this lament for Saul and Jonathan. This is, of course, a public lament. And more than that, we read that David said it should be taught to the people. The people of Judah. He wants this to be known. He wants it to be known not only that he brought justice to the man who killed King Saul, but he wants it to be known that he's deeply grieved over the loss of Saul and indeed the house of Saul with Jonathan and so on. And so he, this great poet in Israel, composes this lament and he cries this lament publicly. He lets the people know then that he is grieved over the loss of Saul and his family. He didn't want to receive the throne in the way in which it might now come to him. He wants again the people of Israel, that is the northern tribes, he wants them to know that he's not anti-Saul. He's not anti-Benjamin. He is pro all the tribes and he wants to bring them all together. So it's again a shrewd political move to woo, to win these northern tribes. And then thirdly, as we read in chapter 2, he sends a message to the men of Jabesh-Gilead. The men of Jabesh-Gilead, we read that in chapter 2 from verse 4 to verse 7. So these were men then who had done good for Saul, weren't they? They had bravely gone and rescued the body of Saul and other members of his family where they'd been strung up. And they had brought them and they'd given them something of a decent burial. They had acted well for Saul and his house. And so David wants to honour that. So he says to them, he sends this message to them, may you be blessed for your loyalty to the house of Saul. And may the Lord show steadfast love to you and so on. He wants to show these particular people that he again is pro the house of Saul. He's pleased with the way that these men of Jabesh-Gilead have acted. And we see his shrewd politics in his words in verse 7, don't we? When he says, having thanked them, praised them then for their good deeds towards Saul, he says, "Now therefore let your hands be strong and valiant, for Saul is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." It's a pretty big hint, isn't it? It's a very big hint, you know, Saul isn't king anymore. You need a new king. Judah's made me king. So he's inviting, but he's inviting them. He's wooing them. He's not trying to force himself upon them. He's acting with a shrewd political, this wise approach in order to woo then the house of Saul and bring them together. And then we read of one of those buts that we get sometimes in scripture of such importance. But in chapter 2, verse 8, "But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and made and brought him to Manahim, and he made him king." So sadly then, David's wise efforts, his shrewd political approach to woo the people of the north, these northern tribes, to recognize him as king, showing his loyalty to Saul in his house, has failed. Abner then installs this puppet king, Ish-bosheth, the surviving son of Saul, a completely useless man. If you read the literature, he's clearly a puppet king under Abner, who's the commander and clearly the power in the north. And sadly, Abner here is imitating the behaviour, the bad behaviour of King Saul, whom he served for so long. Because we read then of how Abner knew full well that David was to be the next king. So in chapter 3, verse 9, a little later, but this shows us what Abner knew. A little later now, when Abner wants to bring the northern tribes over because he's been badly treated by Ish-bosheth, he says then in verse 9 to these people, "God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him." And then again in verse 18, Abner says, "Now then, bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies." So Abner, not surprisingly, knows full well that David has been anointed as the king to succeed Saul. But just as Saul refused to accept that truth, as we've seen when he was alive and he sought to kill David, pursuing him all over the place after trying to kill him in the palace and so on. So sadly, Abner's following his bad example, isn't he? He knows David should be the next king, but he wants power for himself. Just as Saul wanted to cling in his own view to power for himself, so does Abner. So he installs his puppet king, Ish-bosheth, in the north and precipitates civil war. He precipitates a civil war that we read of then in the following chapters. First of all, we have this rather peculiar outbreak of one-on-one combat between representatives from the north and the south. But the key thing in this, as through all that follows, is that David is not involved. David is not involved in any of this civil war behaviour. He's not involved in this hand-to-hand slaughter by this pool of Gibeon, where representatives from the Judah and representatives from the north kill each other in a hand-to-hand combat. He's not involved in the battles that follow. It's all between Joab and his commander and Abner, the commander from the north. David is conspicuously absent in all of this because he's not wanting to achieve the throne by violence. He's not wanting to achieve the throne by force. As I think I commented before, when we thought about Saul pursuing David, David never turned on Saul to attack him. He had these mighty men. He had the greatest warriors in Israel with him. He had this elite force, as we'd say, these crack troops of 600 in the end, and they're with him now. There's no doubt he could easily have conquered and become king that way. There's no doubt he could have led those men into battle and destroyed Ish-bosheth and Abner and so on. But he doesn't want to do that. He isn't involved in any of this warfare. This isn't the way that he wants it to go. Rather, he wants to be a king who achieves, through this political astute approach, a kingdom by this peace, these peaceful means. So as the war unfolds, then we read of the foolish behavior then of Ish-bosheth in chapter 3, where he accuses Abner, this powerful man who pushes him around. He accuses him of sleeping with one of his concubines. So Abner thinks, I've had enough of this useless guy. I'm going to go over to David. So he parleys with David. And David understandably engages. He sees a way then now again of bringing these tribes together, ending the civil war and bringing about a united kingdom. And we read then, as David does this, of the language of peace. We read the language of peace in chapter 3, 21, 22 and 23 in relation to Abner. So Abner has come and David sends him away in peace. And that's repeated for us in what we might feel is a very tedious way in these verse after verse after verse. But the prophet's doing this to make the point. This is the way David wants it to be. Verse 21 then of chapter 3, we read, so David sent Abner away and he went in peace. Verse 22, then the servant of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with him. But Abner was not with David, for he'd sent him away and he had gone. Abner had gone in peace. And when Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king and he's let him go and he has gone in peace. David wants through Abner to establish a peaceful transition to the throne over a united Israel. But as you read on, you find that once again, this is undone. It's undone this time by the murderous behaviour of Abner, who slaughters Abner in cold blood. And in this section then, as David is working towards the throne again by this peaceful, political, wise means, then we again have three examples of how he tries to achieve this, how he tries through shrewd politics to achieve a peaceful transition, not the way of violence, not the way of force, not the way of war. And so we have, first of all, what might not seem the most obvious thing, it might seem a bit of a grim thing, which is when he says to Abner, look, I'll work with you, but you need to bring Michal. You need to bring Michal to me as my wife. So we read of that from 3 verse 12 and so on. So the messengers come and David says, good, I'll make a covenant with you. But one thing, chapter 3 verse 13, one thing I require of you is that you should not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. And so this woman's taken away from her second husband, Paltiel, by force and brought to David. Now, you might think this is a bit of a grim thing, but we need to remember that Michal is actually legally David's wife. She's legally still David's wife. And crucially, of course, she's a daughter of Saul, so that David can then install her, as it were, as his wife, as a daughter of Saul, as his queen, thereby showing publicly, with a queen from the house of Saul, a queen from the north, with him as king from the south, that he's bringing together a united Israel. So this is why David behaves in this way. He wants to show Israel again that he desires a united kingdom. And what better way to do this than such a marriage alliance? It's a time-honoured procedure, isn't it? You read history of our country and other countries. This is what happens again and again. Political marriages to seal unions between different parts of a country or different countries. This is what David is doing. It's a shrewd political move to bring then a queen who can represent the house of Saul and the north. So again, he's showing he's favourable towards. He's not against Saul and his house. He's favourable to it. He wants Saul's daughter to be his queen. But then also, he mourns for Abner. We have another lament. It's much shorter than the first lament, but we have another lament. This time in chapter 3, verse 33 and 34, over Abner. And the lament's associated then with a whole pattern of mourning behaviour from David, as we read on. David then is lamenting away. He's weeping. and so on. And he's making it very clear then to the people of Israel that he had absolutely nothing to do with this death of Abner. He had nothing to do with this. This wasn't his way. As we've read, he wanted the way of peace. He wanted to bring together all these people. And the people recognized this. We read then the people recognized that the king had nothing to do with the death of Abner. And this is crucial again politically. Again, I'm not saying this was a pretend thing. I'm sure he is grieved for the death of Abner and so on. He would have known Abner very well from serving together in the army in the past. Genuine grief, but he's also aware, and the prophet is aware in presenting this, of the important politics of this. He's wanted to make clear he was not responsible for this murderous act. This was Joab acting without any say-so from David. And then the third element in which, again, we have David acting shrewdly politically is when he again has put to death, this time the murderers of Ish-bosheth. So again, it replicates what we've seen earlier. Early remember, it was Saul who'd been slain and this Amalekite claiming he'd killed Saul, and David is him put to death. So in chapter 4, we read of the murder in his own bed, in his own tent of Ish-bosheth by these two bandits. And these two bandits, again, they think, you know, they're going to curry favor with David again. And they come and they proudly declare what they've done in killing Ish-bosheth. And they bring his head to David and they're expecting reward. And again, David is the opposite of what they expect. He's angry with them and he has them put to death. Has them killed because they have killed Ish-bosheth and David had nothing to do with it. And again, as he wanted to show the northern tribes that he was not pleased with his individual, this Amalekite who killed Saul, or so claimed to have done so, he's not pleased with his death of Ish-bosheth either. He wasn't seeking this, he didn't ask it, and he acts against it. And you can see, actually, if you're interested in the literary balance here, you have this balance of the three before the Civil War, the three episodes and the three episodes after. We on each occasion have a lament. We on each occasion have a judicial act against a murderer who's killed a king in cold blood. And we have in each an action that shows very publicly how he's pro the house of Saul, favouring Jabesh-Gilead and bringing then Michal as his wife. So David then, he's acting politically shrewdly to bring these people together. And the result finally, is, as we read in verse 5, that David achieves the end. He gets to point B, as I've said. He gets to this point where we read in verse 5, all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, and again in verse 3, all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron. This is what he wanted. He wanted a peaceful transition, and he wanted these men of the north, these Israelites, to come voluntarily. He didn't want to force himself upon them by violence. He didn't want to pursue the way of war. He knew he could do that, but that would not achieve a united kingdom. That would not achieve a united people of God. The way of violence does not bring a peaceful kingdom. It does not bring a united kingdom. David wanted to achieve that, and so he sought through those shrewd political moves to get to that end. Now, you might say, well, this is all very kind of political and so on. And it is, but it's showing that, you know, as a king, as a leader, David has to pursue, and he does pursue a path, a way of peace, shrewdly, cleverly, wisely. And this is a right way of governing, is the point. This is a right way, the right way to govern. But also, of course, David is doing this as a man of God. He does this as a man of God. And the writer, the prophet, also wants us to see this. We see this in general terms because we know that David then is the anointed king. He's been waiting patiently through Saul's reign to become king. He knows he's the anointed. Everyone else knows he's the anointed king. Everyone else knows he has to succeed. When Saul dies, he doesn't grab at it. He waits patiently and pursues this shrewd political way because he wants the people with him as king united together under his rule. That's what he needs to achieve, not forcing himself upon them. So he has to wait patiently for the Lord to bring it about in his own time, using, yes, his political shrewdness, but to bring the tribes and all the leaders together, as we read in verse 5. And he has to wait 7 years. 7 years David patiently waits upon the Lord. 7 years on top of all those years of waiting before Saul died. 7 years not using violence. 7 years not using the power of war that he could have used. Just as he hadn't used that before against Saul, he won't use it now. And 7 years then in which he was doing this in accordance with the will of God. And we see this from the way in which we read of David, or we read earlier of David seeking the Lord's will before and after the civil war, before the beginning of this period and after at the end of this period. So in chapter 2, verse 1, then we read, and David inquired of the Lord. We presume using the Urim and Thummim. David inquires of the Lord, shall I go up into any of the cities? The Lord says to him, go up. And then David again inquires as to which I shall go, and he says to Hebron. So David is seeking the Lord, to say presumably using the Urim and Thummim. But then if we turn forward to chapter 5 and verse 19, here now, having brought the kingdom together, having conquered the Jebusites and seized Jerusalem, he now wants to make war against the Philistines who've come up against him. And so he says in verse 19, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? And the Lord said to David, go up, for I'll certainly give the Philistines into your hand. And so there's one major defeat. And then it's the same again in verse 23, when again we read, David inquired of the Lord. And the Lord said, you shall not go up, and so on. And my point is that the prophet's saying at the beginning of David, when Saul's dead, at the beginning of this period, when Saul's died, he can take over as king. He seeks the Lord's will. He seeks the Lord's will. At the end, after he's got the throne, he's again seeking the Lord's will. It's before, it's after, and therefore the implication is clear. Throughout this period, David is seeking the Lord's will. So although I've talked, if you like, in a very human way, because that's the way it's laid out for us in all this political manoeuvring, if you want to put it negatively, what I've said is wise decision making and wise actions, wanting to woo and win over a united people. This is also done seeking the will of the Lord, walking with the Lord. You read through the text, we read of the Lord and David again and again throughout the intervening chapters. And at the beginning and the end, it's explicit. He's seeking the will of God. So throughout, he's with the Lord. He's wanted to seek the will of the Lord. And the way he's behaving in trying to bring about this peaceful transition, using wise political decisions and so on, this is in accordance with the will of the Lord that he's seeking throughout to achieve a peaceful, united kingdom. And of course, when he does so, this kingdom then is able to defeat the enemies. And so he's achieved those aims for the kingship that, as I said, Saul completely failed to achieve. He's defeated the Philistines. He's destroyed them as a force. And he's united the people together. These are the aims of the king, and these are what David achieved. I just want to draw a couple of lines of application as we draw to a close. I don't usually do this, but on this occasion I've decided we'll have a couple of lines of application. And the first is political. And I certainly don't usually do this, but a political line of application. So some of you will know in history that you read of this thing called the divine right of kings. And Christians, when they talk about the divine right of kings and sometimes think that this is right, they will point to David. And that's true in that David was certainly the divinely appointed and anointed king. But what I've been wanting to show you is that David did not act like a Louis XIV. Or a Charles I in this country. He was not a murderous tyrant who killed his political opponents and forced his will upon an unwilling people. he was anything but that. Although he was, if anyone was a divine right king, it's David. And yet David did not act with force. He did not use his power. He did not force himself on the people. He wanted to win them. He wanted to woo them because he knew that that's the way of peace and the way to achieve a united kingdom. And it would be overdoing it to say that David was kind of seeking some kind of democratic mandate. That would be certainly anachronistic to read back how we speak today into the past. But the fact that first Judah comes to David to ask him to be king, and then all the tribes come to David and they ask him to be king, they make the effort, they're coming to him, they're wanting him to be their king, shows then that they are authorizing, they're recognizing and authorizing him as their king. So yes, he is the divinely appointed and anointed king, but he also has a real authority, a legitimacy given him by the people over whom he rules, doesn't he? They recognize this. And therefore, he is able to govern over a united people because they know that he is a king that they have acknowledged and wanted as king. And it's this balance. Both are true. There is authority in the people to recognize the king or any leader, and there is authority given by the Lord to the leader. Evangelicals today, we perhaps jump to Romans 13 and say, you know, the authorities that exist have been established by God. And that's true. Of course, it's true. It's true. But it's also true that authority resides in the people. It doesn't reside in a king on his own who can do what he wants, or a government, a ruler who can do what he wants. It has to be legitimate. There has to be a recognition from the governed of who is the right governor or right ruler or king over them. And that's why our forefathers did not recognize a divine right for kings. They knew their Bible better. And I've tried to show this evening, some of the reasons why they arrived at the position they did. Not divine right. There is authority with the people as well. And of course, we can apply that in our day. We have a right. We don't just let the government decide what they want and they can do what they want. And we just say, yes, sir, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. We say, no, you cannot do that. And we're allowed to push back against government. Anyway, that's enough of the politics. And then secondly, second line of application is to the church, to the churches, isn't it? It's the same pattern, of course. That rulers, leaders, elders in churches are those who are under shepherds, who are there under Christ, under our God, and have authority from him to rule, to lead in a church. But also, that authority comes through the people in the church. It comes through the congregation. Both are true in the country, both are true in a gospel church, both are true in any true church. The people in the congregation recognize the leadership and want to follow the leadership, but the leadership do not act as divine right kings, do not throw their weight around. The servant king we sing is the kind of model of gospel, godly, Christian leadership. And that's how we ought to be in our church. That's the balance that we seek to strive. And having been in this church many years and knowing how the church has been throughout these past 30 years, we have been blessed to have a united leadership, united elders, a united church. And I think by and large, you achieve a good gospel balance between the congregation following the elders leading, but the elders not pushing and pulling and trying to dominate or move the congregation where we as a congregation don't want to go. And may the Lord enable us to continue to work together and to work as a church then in this way, achieving this right balance that David showed between his authority from God, but also wanting his legitimate authority from the people over whom he governed. Amen. So let's close with number 146.